Our next case is 13-1622, Disciplinary Counsel versus Harlan Hale. For the relator.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor, distinguished members of this court, my name is Joe Caligiuri. I represent the Office of Disciplinary Counsel in this matter. Relator has two objections to the board's report. The first objection is to this recommended sanction. Had respondent testified truthfully at his disciplinary hearing, relator would not be objecting to the board's recommendation of a 6-month suspension from the practice of law. But he didn't. The board specifically found that respondent's testimony was false and misleading. Consequently, relator urges this court to impose a sanction of greater than 6 months to protect the public and send a message that it's not appropriate in any circumstance to lie under oath. Relator's second objection deals with the board's dismissal of the 8.4H violation, which is conduct adverse or reflecting on the lawyer's fitness to practice law. When a sitting judge dismisses his friend and lawyer's speeding ticket, then creates false journal entries, and engages in a series of improper ex parte communication to conceal his misdeeds, that is conduct that is so egregious so as to warrant the additional finding that it reflects on the fitness to practice law. With regard to the sanction, this case is fairly unique. First of all, the facts of this case have never been in dispute. To his credit, the respondent admitted the misconduct when he was confronted with it. But it's the procedural aspect of this case that is critical to relator's position. When relator filed its complaint in May of 2013, approximately a week to 10 days later, respondent resigned his position from the bench. That was May 24th, 2013. Subsequent to that, the parties got together. We engaged in a full set of comprehensive stipulations, fact, law, rule violations, and recommended a 6-month actual suspension from the practice of law. And we did that via a consent to discipline agreement. That agreement was accepted by the panel. That agreement was then accepted by the board, and it was sent up to this court for review and consideration. And this court rejected our consent agreement with a statement stating it wanted greater consideration for a more severe sanction. And that is what makes this case very interesting. Because on remand, after the court rejected the consent agreement, the only issue in the case, from the respondent's perspective, was alleviating any concern the panel and ultimately this court would have with the recommendation of a 6-month actual suspension.
Mr. Caligiuri, do you have a specific recommendation?
I would say, because it involves the respondent's dishonest conduct and his integrity, that at the very least, at a minimum, this court should impose an additional 6 months or a 1-year suspension that would basically send a message to all lawyers and judges that you cannot misrepresent during a disciplinary hearing. And it also would protect the public. As we know from this case, respondent is intending to continue to practice law.
Was the untruthful testimony subsequent to the remand of this court?
Yes, and that is, it was subsequent to the remand, and that's another reason why this case is unique. When the case went before the board on remand, the respondent testified that from the time he left the bench on May 24th, 2013, until late November, early December 2013, that he had taken a hiatus and he had not practiced law at all. And the reason why he said that was because he was trying to make sure that the panel was okay with the 6-month suspension that he was agreeing to. So in other words, he was saying, look, I'm agreeing to a 6-month suspension, but I also pretty much self-imposed a suspension of 6 months because I didn't practice law between May and November.
And there was nothing to preclude him from practicing law on the 25th of May when he left the bench.
No. In fact, the first time he practiced law was simply 19 days after he left the bench.
And what kind of cases was he handling? There were 5 cases that he forgot?
Yes, there were 5 cases. Relator would submit he didn't forget, and that's why the board found it was false and misleading. There were 5 cases that he handled in the same court that he had just resigned from.
In the housing court?
Well, in the municipal court, but okay. As a housing judge or environmental law judge, he also rotated through and did the same type of work as the other municipal court judges.
So he represented clients in municipal court?
Yes.
On what kind of cases?
OVI cases, traffic cases, protection order cases, things of that nature, misdemeanor cases.
Did he ever correct the misrepresentation to anyone?
Yes. And another reason why it's unique is after the case closed, and because it was a fully stipulated case.
When you say after it closed?
After the record closed and with the board, okay?
Okay.
After respondent testified he didn't practice law. He then, approximately a couple months after the hearing, submitted a motion to correct the record after it had been brought to his attention that his testimony was false, that he had in fact practiced law. And he submitted an affidavit stating, look, when I was testifying, I simply forgot that I had practiced law. And that is absolutely inconceivable. Here's a judge that had been on the bench.
So the affidavit indicates that he had done it, and he submitted that to your office?
To the board.
To the board?
Yes.
Okay. And go ahead, Chief.
At that point, the board had already reconsidered based on the hearing, the remand hearing. The board had already considered what they were going to do with this case?
Yes, the board...
After the remand hearing and before the affidavit admitting that he had practiced law?
The board was deliberating at that time and had not issued its report yet.
Okay.
And this isn't in the record, but Relator and Mr. Johnson called the board. We had a pretrial conference and let them know that there was an issue in the hearing, and they held off on the report until Mr. Johnson submitted the motion to correct, and then we responded.
So that's the point. At the time the board issued its subsequent determination following the hearing where this misrepresentation was made, the board had the affidavit of counsel indicating a misrepresentation, and so it considered that affidavit before it made its second recommendation.
That's correct.
So the board knew of this misrepresentation at the time it recommended the same sanction to us.
Yes.
Of a six-month suspension.
Absolutely.
All right.
And that's Relator's objection, is that they did not apply the appropriate weight to such a serious aggravating factor.
Not that the board didn't know about it. The board knew about it, but made its determination in spite of it.
Exactly.
And you think the board made a mistake and should have given it more weight and made a different determination.
Right. And the reason is because if you look at his affidavit, which lists out the five cases that he represented individuals on and at least seven court appearances in that six-month period, it's just inconceivable that a person that had served on the bench for 10 years would just not remember that he had practiced law, when the whole reason for this hearing, from respondent's perspective, was to alleviate any concerns that the six-month sanction was not severe enough. So he was misleading the panel into believing, and misleading this court ultimately, into believing that really he was going to end up serving a year because he had self-imposed the 6 months himself, and then he was agreeing to an additional 6 months. So it's not just one misstatement. It had a huge effect on his presentation of his case.
Was part of his argument that I just forgot because, golly, I didn't hardly get paid anything for doing all of this?
Yes, in his affidavit he stated, to the best of his recollection, he doesn't believe he was paid for any of the work, and Relator would submit that that is completely irrelevant. It's a red herring. The fact whether or not he was paid shouldn't matter. He was representing clients in the same court in which he sat as a judge. There's just no way he forgot this, and the board was right. He lied, and he did it to mislead the panel. They just didn't afford any weight
to
it.
So if he, while he's awaiting his punishment, he was still licensed to practice law?
Yes.
And if he went down to the senior center and did pro bono work, he would be practicing law?
Right. If he was giving legal advice, yes.
And that would be a black mark against him?
Not really. He had the right to practice law. It's just that he couldn't come into court and then say, hey, I've self-imposed a suspension. So we're not saying that he didn't have the right to practice law. It's just that he testified falsely that he hadn't when, in fact, he had.
And then and you argue that his affidavit is also false because it's inconceivable.
Sure.
That he couldn't remember.
Absolutely.
So therefore, the affidavit is false.
Right. And that's basically what the board found, because the affidavit states that he simply couldn't remember. So the board found that that testimony where he said he didn't practice was false and misleading. So obviously they didn't believe what he wrote in the affidavit.
Right.
So the second objection that Relator has is to the dismissal of the 8.4H violation. Last year in Disciplinary Council versus Bricker, this court decided that 8.4H violations were going to be treated as catch-all provisions of the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct. This court stated there are two times when an 8.4H should be charged. The first time that it should be charged is when there's proof of clear misconduct, but no specific rule prohibiting the misconduct. That's not what we're dealing with here. The second issue is when the proof of the misconduct is so egregious that it would require or warrant an additional finding that the conduct adversely reflected on the lawyer's fitness to practice law. And I would submit to you that there are four reasons why this court should reinstate the 8.4H violation. As I mentioned, first of all, this conduct is so egregious. If you just think about the fact for a second that we have a sitting judge in the state of Ohio fixing a personal speeding ticket for a friend and his lawyer who was representing him at that time in civil cases, then creates a false entry to pin it on the prosecutor who was unaware of any of this, then engages in several improper ex parte communications after the matter comes to light in an effort to cover his tracks, it's beyond the pale. It absolutely warrants and reflects adversely on his fitness to practice law. The second reason why you should reinstate the 8.4H is that the respondent himself stipulated that his conduct was so egregious and that it warranted an 8.4H violation. If you look in the stipulations that are part of the record, we actually cite to the Bricker case to let the court know that we considered the fact that this is a catch-all provision, but respondent himself agreed that his conduct rose to that level.
Well, I'm lost on this one. When this case came to us the first time, was that in or out?
It was in.
And it was taken out?
It was taken out, which is my third reason why you should reinstate it. When it went up to you the first time, the panel accepted it, the board accepted it. The court rejected the entire agreement. When it came back on remand, we had the same stipulations in there. The panel again accepted the 8.4H violation, but the board for some reason dismissed it, stating the conduct wasn't egregious enough. And the final reason that you should reinstate the 8.4H is that the precedent since Bricker would support that. In a couple of cases, the Flowers case, Disciplinary Council versus Flowers, which was decided this year, an attorney falsely notarized her client's signature on five occasions. Her client had given her permission to sign the name, but then the lawyer falsely notarized. And this court found that that was an 8.4H violation. In the Turner case, an attorney deposited $250,000 in his trust account and then used it as a personal account. The court found an 8.4H violation there, despite the fact that there was no theft or other commingling in the account.
If we would agree with your analysis, the first time it was presented to us, the sanction was a 6-month suspension, and your office had agreed to that.
Correct.
So the reinstatement of this 8.4H violation does not change the sanction you're seeking?
Not really. The 8.4H is really a matter of principle here. I think it sends a message that this is conduct will not be tolerated. It's egregious. What changes the sanction is the false and misleading testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, before you leave, counsel?
Sorry.
What are you recommending?
We're recommending a sanction of at least 1 year, so an additional 6 months, but we don't feel that any sanction from an indefinite down to a year is off the table, given the severity of the misconduct in misrepresenting to the panel and the board.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Justice O'Connor, distinguished members of the court, George Johnson representing respondent Harlan Hale. This is a single instance of a municipal court judge dismissing a ticket by filing a false entry that said the prosecutor had agreed to dismiss it. That wasn't true. Subsequent to that, he made improper ex parte contact with both the defendant and the prosecutor and tried to get them to sign an entry which would have put it back on the docket. And the prosecutor refused to sign that. This isn't a pattern of conduct. This is one instance. In response to this, disciplinary complaint that was filed against him, Judge Hale resigned his judicial post that he had held for 10 years. In response to the disciplinary complaint, we filed an answer which admitted each and every factual and legal allegation. We entered into a set of stipulations which, again, accepted every fact, every allegation, and stipulated to the authenticity of all the relevant documents.
And have you stipulated to the 8.4H violation that Mr. Caligiuri talked about?
We did.
All right. And how would a stipulated violation be rejected by the board, in your view?
How did the board come to reject it?
If you stipulated that you are guilty of that violation,
yes,
not you, your client, how would the board determine that that wasn't a violation?
Well, this is speculation because obviously I have no firsthand knowledge of their deliberations. But as Mr. Caligiuri said, under the Brickler decision, we have a catch-all. 8.4H can be a catch-all, or it can be applied when the facts are so egregious that they merit it. So the only thing that I can determine that the board may have done is to look at the other instances of judicial misconduct and to say, while this certainly isn't what we expect or will accept from a sitting judge, there are other instances of judicial misconduct which are much worse.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, I guess what troubles me today is it seems like everybody's in agreement on a six-month suspension, just about everybody in the room. But now we bring up the new allegations of an affidavit has been filed saying I didn't practice law, and yet there were five cases in the very court from which he had resigned. Doesn't that stretch credibility a bit far?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Let me try and put it in context so that my answers make sense to you. At this hearing, the time that he had practiced was an issue that we raised. I asked him a question about that, and I think it was just one question. Hale was very emotional at this hearing. His son was there. His wife was there. He cried. He talked about his parents, that he wasn't raised this way. There was a reporter there from the Columbus Dispatch, and Hale knew that. We both knew that. We saw him coming in. So I asked Judge Hale, from the time that you got off the bench.
Counsel, he is no longer a judge.
I stand corrected, Chief Justice. You're absolutely right. I asked respondent, when did you first practice law after you resigned from the bench? And he talked about a specific client that he identified late November, early December of 2013. That was it. And I did argue in the closing that he had already essentially imposed upon himself a period of abstinence from the practice of law. All that's absolutely true. But it doesn't make sense that the testimony was false, knowingly false. It was clearly false. It doesn't make sense that he knew it was false when he gave it for a number of reasons. The cases that he appeared in were, the only cases that he had were public appearances in municipal court. So he was counsel of record, easily determined. He knew the case was going to be reported, and it was. And in fact, people came out and said to him and to disciplinary counsel, but you did practice. And that was that caused him to go back, reconsider, not under the pressure and the emotion of the hearing, and submit an affidavit in which he identified all of those matters.
Counsel, when you were prepping your client for this hearing, did you discuss with him a strategy that we're going to demonstrate that you had self-imposed abstinence from the practice of law?
Actually, it came up that morning for the first time. We discussed it right before the hearing.
All right, you just said this is a good thing that we can represent to on the rehearing, that there's a self-imposed, and this was before the actual question was asked of him. So he had some time to reflect on what his answer would be to you when you brought up this point that you thought was in his favor?
I didn't reveal a strategy. I just asked him the question. How long was it since you, you know, what's your
practice? But he knew you were going to ask that question.
I don't know if he knew it or we were having a conversation. I was asking him a number of things.
When?
That morning.
That morning, before he was on the stand crying and distraught.
It's true.
So he had time to reflect on what his answer should have been.
Well, respectfully, the emotion of that day didn't start when he took the stand. I mean, he knew why he was there, and he was agitated. And let me add one other point to this.
So because he couldn't collect his thoughts to answer truthfully, we should take that into consideration.
Well, I would ask you to take into consideration the fact that we corrected the record.
After it was brought to his attention by people who would say, Cullen, he didn't tell the truth under oath.
As he said in his affidavit, he said this was brought to my attention after the hearing. And I now recollect that I represented folks in these matters. And I submit that if I had known that he had represented people in five instances pro bono, that would have been better testimony than saying he didn't practice. It's more admirable to have worked for nothing than not to have worked. So, if you analyze
it
logically.
Well, let's just examine that statement.
Yes.
Did he expect to get paid and they just didn't pay him? I mean, that's what I get the impression here is it didn't start out as pro bono representation. His clients just neglected to pay him.
I think these were favors. He got phone
favors.
Calls. They were all people that knew him. There was a business associate of his who had somebody who had a civil protective order. He got a call to represent somebody at an arraignment. He was a previous municipal court judge.
I can't recall. Is that contained in his affidavit that this was pro bono?
Yes, Chief Justice. He says, to the best of my recollection, each of these matters was pro bono.
He uses the phrase pro bono. I was not paid. Isn't there a difference?
No, I think he says pro bono. I can look at the affidavit, which I have here, but okay. I think that was his testimony. And so, it's not a core issue in the disciplinary proceeding. He has completely owned everything that was the subject of the complaint. And the question is, what is this untruthful testimony on a non-central matter? What should that do to the sanction that's imposed? And one of the cases that you decided in July of this year, the Wexler matter, is exquisitely helpful on that issue. Because if you recall in Wexler, the respondent was found guilty only of being untruthful during the disciplinary process. All of the other allegations against him failed. And that was the only issue that was before this court. And you imposed upon him a 6-month stayed suspension for being untruthful in the disciplinary process. And so, much like the 8.4H violation, there isn't a reason to change the sanction in this case. The other case of ticket fixing in Ohio is Disciplinary Council versus Smakula, which is significantly different because of the scope of that. In that case, there was a scheme. There were three misdemeanor convictions. And that year, in that case, the respondent received a 1-year suspension. There are a number of cases that were in the joint brief that we filed with disciplinary counsel that's in the record, which categorizes cases from other jurisdictions involving ticket fixing. And those sanctions range from public reprimand to 75-day suspensions, 6-month suspensions. But there are a number of cases from other jurisdictions that would lead one to believe that a 6-month suspension is actually on the heavy side for a single instance of fixing a ticket. I would like to discuss the 8.4H allegation. We stipulated to it. There's no question about that. And we didn't oppose it in the brief. I would raise one matter for your consideration, and it's a procedural matter. The board, when it dismissed that count, signed a separate entry on the same day that the report and recommendation was issued, requiring the board secretary to issue notice required under GovBar Rule 5, Section 6K, to all of the people, the parties who needed notice of the dismissal, that it had in fact been dismissed. And so I question whether this court, under its precedent, in previous matters, has the ability to review that dismissal since the board complied with Section 6K appropriately. Hearing no other questions, I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Caligiuri, you have 30 seconds.
Thank you. I'd like to just address two matters. First, starting with the board's notification that it dismissed the 8.4H. If you look at the rule, GovBar Rule 5, Section 6J, it talks about board review. The board has the power to dismiss a complaint in its entirety. If it does that, it must give notice to the parties, and then relator has no ability to appeal that dismissal to this court for de novo review. Subsection H deals with the panel dismissing a charge or account. And if the panel dismisses a charge or account and they give notice to relator, bar associations, and the like, then the relator cannot raise that issue. It cannot go before the board or this court. So I think Mr. Johnson's argument's incorrect. 6H only deals with dismissal of the complaint in its entirety, not a charge. So the 8.4H is appropriately before this court.
He cited K. What about K?
I think that was a miscite in one of the cases. K deals with the actual sanctions. I think it's H and J. The other issue I just want to address very briefly is the Wexler case. And that is easily distinguishable in that, first of all, it was a misrepresentation involving sex with a client during a disciplinary investigation. The entire rest of the case was dismissed. Mr. Wexler was not a judge, and Mr. Wexler was not testifying under oath. Here we have a sitting judge who lied under oath, and there must be consequences for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.